Here in the Infinite Inning, we try to make the best of an impossibly bad situation, a situation that, by definition, can really never be good. I suppose some people will argue that, given the situation that I'm referring to. Woody Allen, this is back when he was an auteur rather than a controversial pervert, said, "It's not that I fear death, I just don't want to be there when it happens." I feel the same way. I can think of a lot of bad ways to go and not so many good ones. Just one example that comes to mind. In 1676, Virginia, Bacon's Rebellion fell apart when Nathaniel Bacon was basically devoured from within his jockey shorts by his own bodily vermin. That doesn't seem too pleasant. But in that situation, what is pleasant? There isn't really anything. Now, having said that, I submit the following means of egress, of departure, for your examination. On July 18th, 1934, the Yankees were in Cleveland to play the Indians for what turned out to be a really wild game. It was started by future Hall of Famer Red Ruffing for the Yankees, and by a pitcher who was nearly that good, at least at his peak, Mel Harder, for the Indians. Neither was around for the finish, though, because neither had anything. Both were chased in the fifth inning. And the game went to the bullpens, or what passed for bullpens, in 1934. And in the end, the Yankees took a 14-12 lead to the bottom of the ninth inning, and they blew the game. Lefty Gomez, a future Hall of Fame starter himself, was in there to close it out. That often happened with starters in the 30s. Gomez came in with a man already on second, allowed a triple, a double, and then a walk-off single to another future Hall of Famer, Earl Averill. And the Yankees went down to a loss, and it was an important loss, I guess. They were a very good team in 1934. They went 94-60, which in a lot of years might be good enough to win you a pennant in those days, or a division title today. But the loss dropped them to 2.5 games behind a Tigers team that I guess was even better. They won 101 and went to the World Series, so as far as the final record is concerned, they were better. But if you stare at the two rosters, on paper, at least, they seem very evenly matched. All of that is just background for what I want to tell you about this game. This is something that I noticed while writing about this in the Hardball Times this week in a piece about Babe Ruth's tortured struggles with retirement in 1934 to 1935. He was hurt in this game. He started it, but he wasn't around after the third. In the third inning, Earl Coombs and Jack Salzgraver, the first and second hitters in the Yankees lineup, were on base when Ruth came up, and he hit a single to reach, loading the bases. That brought up Lou Gehrig, and Gehrig pulled a hot smash into the hole between first and second. The ball took one hard hop, and apparently still moving with a great deal of force, smashed into Ruth's right ankle. The newspapers say he went down as if he were shot and was writhing on the ground in agony. Everyone assumed that his leg was broken. Coach Art Fletcher, the same Art Fletcher, by the by, who I mentioned as being shoved by Hal Chase in last week's show, outfielder Sammy Bird, who appropriately comes down to us in history as Babe Ruth's legs for acting as Ruth's defensive substitute in these years, and the trainer had to carry Ruth off with his arms around their shoulders. And as he waited in the clubhouse for an ambulance, he said, "I'm getting out of this game before I'm carried out. If I don't quit now, I may get an injury that will prove permanent. I thought my leg was broken when that ball hit me. Gosh, how it hit, and how this leg pains. I had no business being on first, all things being even. That hit I made was good for two bases instead of being a single, but for the fact that Coombs and Salzgraver were on ahead of me, and there was a possibility of a catch. It looks like fate, doesn't it?" The doctors initially said that Ruth would need to be hospitalized and would be out for 10 days. It didn't turn out to be that bad. He refused the hospitalization and was back out there in 4 days, although he needed another 3 days off after that, so I guess the return was premature. But on the whole, he didn't miss a great deal of time. So, from our perspective, the whole thing looks like much ado about nothing, except that Ruth saying, "I'm getting out of this game before I'm carried out," tends to pop up in biographies as evidence that he was ready to wind the whole thing down at 39, and that soon happened, less than a year later. But if you were there, maybe it was a bit more stressful than that. Ruth himself said, "It looks like fate, doesn't it? unintentionally invoking the three women of Greek myth, the Fates, plural, who spun the thread of your life, measured it, and, when your time was up, cut the thread. And so, I will read to you, in whole, this very brief item from a newspaper of the day. Dateline, Cleveland, July 18. A heart attack during the excitement as Babe Ruth was injured in today's New York-Cleveland baseball game caused the death of Coe Livingston, 66, Kent, Ohio merchant. A resident of Kent for 45 years, Livingston was attending the game with his son, Charles, 38. Now, I don't mean to make light of a son witnessing the demise of his father, and that this event took place nearly 84 years ago makes it no less tragic. But it seems to me that for at least some subset of those of us who love the game, that might be how they choose to go. You know, I have a dear friend who is something of an expert on popular music, and of all bands in the universe, I think she dislikes the 1990s folk rock act Poi Dog Pondering more than any. I don't necessarily endorse this view, but she is so emphatic in her way of stating it that I feel a little uncomfortable quoting them here. They had a song from back in 1990 that contains the couplet, "If I should die in a car wreck, may I have Van Morrison on my tape deck?" It's not anything deep, but for some baseball fans, collapsing along with Babe Ruth might be kind of the same thing. As I said at the outset, no exit is a good exit, but you could do worse than to look at Babe Ruth going down and saying, "Well, if Ruth goes, then I go." That's poetic, but poetry will only take you so far. I'd rather stay. Ruth felt the same way. I could be remembering this wrong, but he passed away in August of 1948, and his old teammates Joe Dugan and Waite Hoyt were the pallbearers. It was a hot day, and they were sweating underneath the weight of the casket, and Dugan said, "I could sure use a beer." And Hoyt said, "Joe, so could the Babe." I'm Stephen Goldman, and this is the Infinite Inning Baseball Podcast. Strange noises had been overheard coming from the long-abandoned Grimpner Mansion, and shadows were observed at play beneath flickering lights. The heirs, wanting very badly to gut the place and turn it into a dozen or so condominiums, sent a pleading invitation to Dr. Herbert Arbuthnot, the world's leading parapsychologist and the Bancroft Chair of the Strange at Harvard University, asking him to examine the premises. He readily, too readily, agreed that Dr. Arbuthnot had been on a bit of a losing streak of late, did not seem to trouble the Grimpner heirs as much as it did Dr. Arbuthnot. He gathered his team, Vivian, the sexually conflicted actress with empathic telepathy, Junior, the now middle-aged former chess prodigy hosting a low-rent ghost-busting show on a third-tier cable network, Doreen, the expert on the history of the Grimpners and a skeptic who happened to have wicked knife skills, and Arbuthnot's own wife, Tabitha, who screamed at the slightest provocation. They entered the house. It was in strangely good condition. There was a new microwave in the kitchen. The refrigerator held platter after platter of fresh-cut vegetables and ranch dip. There was nothing eerie about the place at all. They all milled about aimlessly for days, with nothing whatsoever to investigate. Junior watched sports on television. At one point, Vivian startled. She had felt phantom fingers at play about her ankles beneath her long skirt. The others tensed, at last ready for the confrontation. "Oh," she said, chuckling embarrassedly, "it's only Mr. Mimples, the Grimpner cat." Arbuthnot was near his breaking point. "Damn this house!" he shouted. "I need this place to be possessed. My publisher wants to cancel my contract. The National Geographic Channel won't finance any more documentaries since The Buried Bowling Alley of Lucky Luciano Laid an Egg. This house is less frightening than a home economics class. Do you hear that, house? Do you? I mock you. I scoff at the horrifying edifice of the Grimpners. I taunt you. He broke down and wept quietly. All at once the lights went out. The microwave beeped to life and cooked something that screamed pathetically. Doors and windows slammed. The voices of the damned screamed, and the walls bled. Something is very angry, Vivian said. We've got to run. We'll be safe in episode 55. The laughter was nearby. They all looked up to see Mr. Mimples leering from atop a gargoyle at the foot of the grand staircase. The gargoyle hadn't been there a moment before. Too late, he cackled. Episode 55 won't protect you. No one escapes from the taunted house. Yes, I went all that way just for that pun. Welcome back to the show. Today, it is my great pleasure to be joined by former Major League manager Davey Johnson, who has a new book out. Co-authored with Eric Sherman, it's called Davey Johnson, My Wild Ride in Baseball and Beyond. As you'd expect in our conversation, we touched on many aspects of his career, both as a key player on the great Orioles teams of the late 60s and early 70s, as well as his time with the Mets and Reds, principally. In addition to Davey's many accomplishments, he was truly a ubiquitous figure in baseball for almost 50 years. He managed both Dwight Gooden and Bryce Harper. He was a teammate of Brooks Robinson when Robinson won the 1970 World Series MVP with a defensive showcase that may never have been equaled. And he was there in the hole, not quite on deck, but in the hole, when Hank Aaron broke Babe Ruth's record. And of course, there was that little matter of the 1986 Mets. I will gladly admit to you that I was a little nervous about this one going in. I had gotten the sense over the years that Davey was somebody who did not suffer fools gladly, and I suppose I think of myself as a fool. But as you'll hear, he was as friendly as could be. I will warn you that there's one unexpected interruption. Our time was limited to begin with, and then there was a visitor, someone who was lost in his neighborhood, and the doorbell rang, the dog started barking. I didn't leave all of that in the transcript, but you'll hear a good deal of it. There was just no escaping it. So about, 28, 29 minutes into the discussion, you'll hear things break down and me start to ask Davey if he needs to take a break, and he took me up on that. So I called a quick commercial interruption, and then we started over. He handled that with good humor, too. One other detail I just want to get out front here, although it does come up during the conversation. Proceeds for the book go to Davey's wife's charity, Support Our Scholars. I enjoyed the book. It's a quick read. Davey is very assertive in taking credit for what Davey thinks should be to his credit. You can agree or disagree with some of those things. No doubt other participants in some of these stories will have differing opinions or will want a chunk of the credit. I think most of it is fair, and I also think his record speaks for itself in a lot of those regards. One additional comment by way of a story before I roll Davey in here and play Boswell to Dr. Johnson. Davey's first major league manager was Hank Bauer. And you know how you can be a fan of a player who was before your time, but nevertheless, he's somebody you're kind of attached to? Well, Hank Bauer is one of those guys for me. That's the case for several reasons. First of all, he was a really good player on a really good team. That's the Yankees from 1948 through 1959. He had an unheralded role on that team. People think of him as one of Stengel's platoon players. He was platoon sometimes. There were also injuries, and a lot of years he wasn't particularly platooned at all. He started the vast majority of the games. As with all managers, although Stengel loved to talk about platooning, his platooning was largely contingent. That is, if he could have found a regular for a position, then he would have used one, and quite often Bauer fit the bill. What I mean about an unheralded position is, everyone remembers Phil Rizzuto as the Yankees' primary leadoff hitter during the dynasty years. Tain't so, McGee. He was number two. Three players had over 1,000 plate appearances during the Stengel years, batting first in the Yankees' batting order. In reverse order, they were Gil McDougald, Phil Rizzuto, and Hank Bauer. Hank Bauer had nearly 500 more plate appearances from there, and he led off in postseason games as well. I asked him about this on a few occasions, and he told me he was equally perplexed because he was not a base stealer, and he was not necessarily a big walks guy, but Stengel told him that he was just a good all-around hitter, and he liked the idea that Bauer, who did have really good pop, could start the game with an extra base hit. He was also a war hero. He was a Marine in World War II and fought in the Pacific Campaign. A lot of those island-hopping battles that were so frightening, he was one of the guys storming the beaches. He was wounded at Okinawa, and he was just kind of fun to talk to. He had a voice a bit like fingernails on a chalkboard. It was high and scratchy, and at first I thought maybe he had a laryngectomy somewhere. And he was very intense. You'll hear us talk about this. And I talked to him on about 4 different occasions for, 10 or 15 minutes each. And he would yell at me. He would act very put out to be talking to me. "There, are you satisfied?" he'd say. And then he gave me his phone number. So it was kind of a mixed bag. And it was tense. And I sweat during these kinds of encounters. But it was endearing nonetheless. Bauer did have some success as a manager. He took the Baltimore Orioles to the 1966 World Series and won. And that's something, because whatever came after with Earl Weaver and the gang, and those were great accomplishments, don't get me wrong, but this is the team that had been the St. Louis Browns. It had been down for forever, and no one could make this team work, whether in St. Louis or Baltimore. I don't know how much of the credit Bauer should get, but he won. Davey's contention is that he was bad with pitching. So in preparing to talk to Davey, I thought I would look at the records and see if I could spot some places where his handling of pitchers really jumped out at me as being terrible. And I stopped rather quickly. I got stuck on this one game in 1967, I want to tell you about. And honestly, I don't know if any other manager of the day would have handled this any differently than Bauer did. But it's a notable game because it's a no-hitter. Sort of. It doesn't really count as one now, according to the rules. Beginning in 1957, the Orioles had possession of a wild young lefty, wild in every sense, I think, named Steve Barber. Barber threw very hard, but as with a lot of young lefties, command, control, these were foreign terms. And it took him quite the while to get to the point that he seemed like a viable minor leaguer. They signed him at 19, he was a college dropout, and they sent him to the Paris Orioles in the Sooner State League, which is a very low level. And his records in the minors are really incredible in terms of that wildness. That first year, he pitched 152 innings and walked 137. That's 8.1 per 9. The next year, pitching at 2 levels, he threw 166 innings, and this is not progress, he walked 166. He also struck out 141, so you can see that there's stuff there. You can also imagine that batters were terrified. 7 of them were hit. There are also 27 wild pitches in the record. And it went on like this for quite a while, until in the spring of 1960, he worked with the Orioles Major League pitching coach, and he somehow got organized enough that he made the Major League staff, and you know, he still led the league in walks. He issued 113 in 181 innings, but he also was impossible to hit a home run against. He was the hardest pitcher in the league to homer off of because his hard fastball, it had a lot of sink. He was top 10 in strikeouts per 9 that year, and batters just couldn't hit the ball for any distance, so all those base runners had to move station to station, and it worked out. Over the course of the next few years, he refined it even more, so that by that pennant-winning championship season of 1966, he was, for his career, at age 28, 91-66, that's a .580 winning percentage, 3.07 ERA, which is, according to Baseball Reference, a 118 ERA plus, and yes, in 1,340 innings, he had walked 607, which is 4.1 per 9, but he had also struck out 870 batters, or 5.8. It was all working out. However, there is a big however. He only made 22 starts in 1966 because his 10-5 2.30 record belies the fact that he was diagnosed with elbow tendonitis. And I don't know what that means in 1966 terms. There were not MRIs. All the doctors could really do is say, "Does it hurt when you do that? Well, don't do that then." It could mean anything from, "Due to delivering telephone books from his bicycle during the winter to make ends meet, Barber has strained his arm," to, "Oh my God, a badger has chewed off your arm." he was left off the postseason roster, so he had to watch as his teammates won it. But okay, he takes the winter off, he comes back in 1967, supposedly everything is all better. In his first start of the season, against the California Angels in Anaheim, he carried a no-hitter to the bottom of the ninth. He retired the first batter, but Jim Fregosi, who was probably the best hitter on the Angels in those days, doubled. Barber stranded him there, and it went down in the book as a one-hit shutout. His next game was a little more complicated. It came against the miserable Kansas City A's, and he allowed only one run in 5.2 on three hits, but he walked nine. His third start of the season is where everything broke. It broke in a very strange way, and this is where Bauer's handling of things comes into question. And again, I'm not sure that any manager would handle it differently. You be the judge. On April 30th, the Orioles hosted the Tigers. The Tigers had a good team with a strong lineup. The starters that day included Dick McAuliffe, Mickey Stanley, Don Wirt, Al Kaline, Jim Northrup, Bill Freehan, Norm Cash, Ray Oyler. Okay, Ray Oyler couldn't hit at all. And Earl Wilson, the pitcher, who was pretty good. And I mean both as a pitcher and as a hitting pitcher. This is a guy with 35 career home runs. We don't really need to detail the lineup on the Orioles side, except to say that it happens that Davey was not in this game. Although he was a starter that year, he was rested this day. Woody Held, the veteran infielder, started at second. Mark Belanger came in as a defensive replacement later. I won't drag this out. There's a first time for everything. Even I can be terse sometimes. And suffice it to say that that Tigers lineup could not get a hit off of Barber. What they could do is draw walks and reach on errors. They kept doing that throughout the game, but they couldn't score. One reason was that they kept bunting themselves out of innings. They had four sacrifices in that game. Whenever somebody got on, they'd try to push him over. Didn't really help. Barber wasn't really striking anyone out either, just three in the whole contest. The thing went scoreless into the bottom of the eighth. The Orioles finally got a run that inning. So, they have a no-hitter intact, they have a 1-0 lead going to the top of the ninth. Barber, sore arm and all, has walked 7 in 8 innings. Today we would yank that guy, we've seen it several times now. Two examples that happen to come to mind are Yankees examples, one over 20 years ago now, and the other one recent. In 1996, David Cone missed a good chunk of the season after having an aneurysm removed from his shoulder. He came back against the A's at Oakland on September 2nd, pitched 7 no-hit innings, and yeah, he got pulled because the risk was too great. He threw 85 pitches, and they felt that that was all that safety could tolerate. And just about 2 weeks ago, at the time of this recording, the Yankees had Domingo Germán making his first start of the season at home against the Indians, and he threw 6 no-hit innings, and the Yankees yanked him again around the same place, 84 pitches. Because he wasn't all that stretched out. In fact, this is almost commonplace now. In 2018, we've had 2 no-hitters, one by James Paxton, one by Sean Manea. But 4 pitchers, in addition to Germán, have been yanked in the 6th inning with no hits on the board. And I think we figured something out. In the same way that a few weeks ago, I was complaining on this show about arbitrary numbers like 3,000 hits and 300 wins, and how if they don't serve team goals, they're really empty things. They're great things for the player on an individual basis, and they speak to a great career, but if the player is no longer a viable contributor, then they really are setting you back, and supposedly what the game is all about is winning. Well, similarly, if a no-hitter endangers a pitcher's health and thus will limit him in the future and limit his ability as a member of the starting rotation to pitch well going forward, what does it do for you? Again, it's a singular achievement by a pitcher. It's kind of neat. I think it's often kind of random. I've said that several different times during the run of this show. Unless the pitcher has a crazy high number of strikeouts, there's a lot of balls in play magic that's happening there that is not purely attributable to the pitcher. But this is a team game, and we know a lot of things now. We know that high pitch counts kill, and we know that the third time through the order can be very depressing for the starting pitcher, and we have relievers who can come out of the bullpen throwing these 100-mile-an-hour bullets of pure, I was going to say love, that's the They Might Be Giants song, Sapphire Bullets of Pure Love, but okay, let's call it that. They come out of the bullpen throwing 100-mile-an-hour Sapphire Bullets of Pure Love, and I don't care who the starting pitcher is, it's very likely that the reliever is the better choice at that time. And sure, no-hitters are fun, they're neat accomplishments, but What you really want is today's W and tomorrow's W and as many W's out of 162 games as you can possibly get. And so you make a change. They didn't think that way in 1967. Bauer did not think that way in 1967, though he did finally wake up. Here's how the ninth inning went. Barber walked Norm Cash to open the inning. He walked shortstop Ray Euler. That brought up pitcher Earl Wilson. Teams didn't always pinch hit for pitchers, even when it would seem obvious, even in a do-or-die situation in the ninth inning when you're losing on the road. They didn't pinch hit for the pitcher. So Wilson bunts the runners over. Second and third, one out. Then, indulging in all kinds of weird strategery, Tigers manager Mayo Smith did pinch hit, this time for his second baseman, with a very good hitter who happened not to start that day, outfielder Willie Horton, a guy who had 325 home runs in the major leagues. You don't pinch hit for your pitcher, but you do pinch hit for your second baseman, who's one of the big on-base percentage guys in your lineup. You're not trying to win the game by giving away outs. I don't really get it, but okay, it was a long time ago. He popped out to the catcher. Two down, Mickey Stanley at the plate. Barber shakes off the catcher a couple of times, bounces a changeup. It gets away. Wild pitch. The runner on third scores. The runner on second moves up to third. Barber's still in there. Hank Bauer's not coming. He walks Stanley. Runners on first and third. At that point, finally, with Barber's 10th walk of the game, Bauer trudges out to the mound. "I tried to get it for you," he said. Barber, to his credit, replied, "If you can't get the ball over, you don't deserve to win." And after the game, he said, "As far as I'm concerned, I should have been out of there in the seventh." Bauer brought in his closer, Stu Miller, to face Don Wirt. Wirt hit a grounder to shortstop Luis Aparicio, which might have been the third out, but when Aparicio threw to second to force the runner, Mark Belanger bobbled the ball. All hands are safe. The go-ahead run scores. It's now 2-1 Tigers. And in the bottom of the ninth, 3-4-5 spots in the Orioles' order are up, but Frank Robinson, Brooks Robinson, and Mike Epstein go 1-2-3. And so, the Orioles pitched a no-hitter and lost. Or maybe a better way of putting it is that Barber pitched 8.2 innings of a no-hitter and lost. And remember what I said just a few minutes ago about subordinating team goals to individual goals? Over Barber's next 12 starts, he threw 51.1 innings, walked 39, and he allowed 36 runs, 32 of them earned. That's a 5.61 ERA at a time when 5.61 is even worse than it is now. And at that point, the Orioles dumped him on the Yankees for a bag of not particularly impressive prospects. I do not mean to suggest that the attempted no-hit start broke Barber. It seems extremely likely that he was broken to begin with. But it also seems fair to say that the long start exacerbated whatever was going on with him. Now, because Barber was left-handed, he managed to hang on in the major leagues for most of the next 8 years. But all in all, from that diagnosis of tendonitis on, remember I said he had a winning percentage just under 600 and an ERA just over 3? Well, for the remainder of his career, he went 30-40 with a 3.96 ERA and 3.96 in the period 1967 to 1974 is very, very poor. That is like a 5 now. I don't know if you indict Bauer for the way he managed that game or not. A lot of managers at that time, all managers practically, kept a pitcher in if he was throwing a no-hitter. Here's a project for another day. Baseball References Play Index lists 46 occasions between 1908 and 1988, including Barber, in which a pitcher was hooked from a game having thrown between 5 and 8.2 no-hit innings. Now, I know some of them were surely instances in which the manager was a bit smarter and more objective than Bauer was on this particular occasion, but what I don't know, and I would like to find out, is how many were for injury, how many were because there was a 2-hour rain delay and they figured the pitcher couldn't loosen up again, how many was the pitcher ejected from. I mean, Pascual Perez is on this list, so it's very possible that somebody threw him out of the game or he just wandered off somewhere. But it's a long list with a lot of great pitchers on it. Whitey Ford, Walter Johnson, Jim Maloney, John Tudor, Charlie Huff, Mike Krukow, Babe Ruth. But for all those managers who did leave the pitcher in, even when it was obvious that the pitcher was laboring, and some of them surely were, if you look at the completed list of no-hitters, there are 10s and 8s and 7s in the walk column. Did anyone ask them why? What purpose did it serve? How did that get you closer to winning a World Series? We'll let that question hang for now. We will take a break for a word from our sponsors, and then when we come back, I'll be in conversation with managerial great Davey Johnson. Hang in there, please. My next guest was a four-time All-Star, a three-time Gold Glove winner, and a two-time Manager of the Year award, and he should have had at least a couple of more of those. He has three winning World Series rings, two as a player, one as a manager, and if I can throw in just one neat extra qualification, he's one of the few players I can think of who ever pinch hit a walk-off grand slam, which he did against Terry Forster and the Dodgers on June 3rd, 1978. His new book is Davey Johnson, My Wild Ride in Baseball and Beyond. It's my honor to welcome him. How are you, Davey?
I'm doing great, Stephen. Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure, and thanks for taking the time. I'd like to start with one of my favorite tactics of yours that made me so excited to watch the games that you managed going back to the 1980s. You had Howard Johnson, who was a third baseman who, and you can testify to this firsthand from being a teammate of Brooks Robinson, was not exactly Brooks on defense. And yet, on certain days, say when Sid Fernandez, who would go whole games without a grounder, would pitch, you would list him at shortstop. And I guess you just figured on days like that, infield defense didn't matter quite as much.
No, and when Sid pitched, it was usually a strikeout or a fly ball. He had this funny delivery. Kind of hit the delivery, came out of his shirt, and it kind of rose. And there weren't a lot of ground balls that I've said ever.
You know, some managers seem to be very worried about what will happen. And I realize this is part of a manager's job to think two innings ahead, three innings ahead. But it's kind of like that situation where you don't want to pinch hit for the starting catcher if you only have one backup on the roster, because what if lightning strikes the second guy and you suddenly don't have a catcher? So you were able to overlook in moments like that, well, what if I have to yank Sid early? What if suddenly Roger McDowell's in the game and he gets three grounders for every fly ball? You were willing to chance that risk.
Well, there's no question about it. You have to have confidence in your players. And, you know, I always tried to put the best lineup up there that had a chance to score the most runs. And I had a great bunch of guys, and they understood it. You know, everybody has a role, and when you can use them in a lot of different roles. I think they've gone a little overboard today because, I mean, a lot of right fielders come in to play second base, and they don't know the footwork, and they get taken out. And, of course, the rule changed because of Chase Utley. Now they have to slide straight in, but it's a little different game right now.
It's funny, as you were talking, I was just thinking about what I said about running out of catchers, and I don't know if you ever did, but one of your managers, actually, your first major league manager, Hank Bauer, who was a right fielder, ended up having to catch for the Yankees a couple of times because Casey Stengel ran out of catchers, and they lost those games. But at the end of the day, it's just one loss, and I guess the gamble that he took strategically to pinch hit for his catcher seemed worth it at the time.
You don't ever want to weaken your defense, though, and also you run the risk of a guy getting injured, you know. You know, Hank Bauer, he managed me, and he was a dandy. He was a tough ex-Marine, and he'd rather fight than figure out strategy. But I enjoyed playing for him.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about him. I got to talk to him a few times before he passed away, and as you said, he was quite a character. He had this high, reedy voice, and I don't know if that was from a lifetime of smoking cigarettes or just the way that he was even then. But he told me about a deal that, maybe this was really Hank Peters, but he said that he had negotiated to swap Mike Epstein, who was a first base prospect for the Baltimore Orioles at that time, this is in 66, 67, to the Cubs for Billy Williams, and that someone in Orioles ownership or management turned that down. I can't quite figure out why, because they dealt Epstein not long after that. Anyway, but what he said to me was, he uttered kind of a curse and said, "And I'd still be there." And just from reading your book, I imagine that you'd say that wouldn't have been the best outcome for the franchise.
No doubt about it. You know, of course, I had Earl Weaver, and I thought he was a genius in handling pitching staff. And the way he set it up, the bullpen, and the way he used the bench and the bullpen, which is the key to being a successful manager. Hank had no clue on those issues, and it was unfortunate. I did like Hank, but he was a tough guy, and we butted heads occasionally, to say the least.
You know, you told a story in the book in which he was talking to you about hitting, and it didn't sound, from the way you described it, like a particularly heated conversation, and yet he ended up punching an airplane bulkhead and breaking his hand, just talking about the way you looked at pitches during an at-bat.
Yeah, he said, he asked me, he said, "Are you a guess hitter?" And I said, "No, I'm not a guess hitter. I look for a fastball every pitch, because that's the fastest one they throw, and I adjust off it." And that's what he said. "Just what I said, you're a guess hitter." And he hit the bulkhead. I mean, you know, guess hitting, you would sometimes look for a curveball and a slider or a changeup. That's guess hitting. When you set your timing on the fastball, that's not guess hitting. He was just a little bit different. You know, he was known as a first ball fastball hitter. And I'm sure he got off of that at times and guessed breaking ball. And he had a lot of great hits in his career. But, you know, he didn't like the thought that, you know, somebody would, when he'd say, "You're a guess hitter," I'd say, "No, I just look for a fastball." That went against what he was thinking.
Earl Weaver comes along after that, and he was somebody that you knew going back to the minor leagues. And one of the things that you brought up in the book, and I really appreciated this, you were an early proponent of a rational approach to baseball, what we would call sabermetrics now, but of course it wasn't called that then. And the fortunate thing about that was that computer technology was evolving at roughly the same time that you were studying this. So whereas somebody like, I mentioned Casey before, he had a good grasp of the stats, but they were all in his head, and Earl had note cards, I guess. And you were able to do stuff with computer programs and optimized lineups. And you talk about giving Earl a study in which this must have been about late 67, 68, where you advocated for yourself batting second. And I have to be honest, you said, and maybe this was the result that you got back then, that optimizing the lineup would have added 80 runs to the season. And I actually looked up at my wife and I said, "That's a lot bigger of a jump than most studies say that an optimized lineup, but maybe if Earl had been batting Belanger second, then it would make sense." So I looked it up, and indeed, he was batting Belanger second all season. And I know you know, but for those who don't know, Belanger was the defensive shortstop from, say, the mid-60s to the late 70s, but really didn't hit very much. So I'm curious how much of an influence you were on Earl in this regard, because we remember him as the walks and three-run homers guy, but at the beginning of his major league career there, he was batting someone with a .280 on base percentage up in the second spot.
Well, you know, I had it, when I was in there, I did the computer stuff on a big old IBM 360, and you had to use key punch cards to program it. But I also had lunch with a guy named Earnshaw Cook, who wrote Percentage Baseball. And in the early 60s or late 60s, he used on base percentage with walks and hits. Elias didn't even use that. They didn't use the on base percentage back then. And I thought that was great, because the optimum lineup was to have on base guys, high on base percentage guys batting one and two, and then your run producers, extra base hit guys throughout the lineup. And the worst on base percentage hit last. And if you always did it that way, you'd have more guys to come to the plate and more chances to score runs. I used to take him in the Weaver, and he'd use five at-bats for a hitter to decide if he was going to play or not against a pitcher. And I said, "Earl, to be able to predict with a plus or minus 5%, you need 500 chances." And, of course, he didn't understand all that. It was called a variable chance deviation. It was way above his head. But I know he listened, and even though he chased me out of his office.
So does it drive you nuts today if you're watching a game or a post game and after the game? And I realize, look, you've been in the position of being second guessed a million times, and I'm not trying to be that guy. I understand that when you're sitting in the dugout, the game is moving a lot faster than it is in the stands or at home on television. But when a manager, you know, is asked, well, why did you bring in that pitcher to face that guy? And he says, well, I didn't like the matchup. He was 2-for-5 against him. And that's when I get really frustrated, because as you just pointed out, 2-for-5 doesn't really mean anything unless you're seeing something really obvious about the pitcher's selection and the hitter's abilities. 2-for-5 could just be two bleeding grounders. It's almost totally random.
Well, there's no question about it. And, you know, I always say, you know, a lot of times, anytime you put garbage in the computer, you're going to get garbage out. And, I mean, this launch angle and this velocity off the bat, it doesn't mean a whole lot, because it does is confuse the situation. Logic will dictate, you know, percentages, and you go with them. And, you know, one thing, even Earnshaw Cook, he came out and said, well, you know, if a guy's a 250 hitter, when he gets two balls and no strikes, he wrote in the book, the guy should never swing, because the percentages are he'll walk more than he'll get a hit. I said, well, Earnshaw, you can't do that, because we're dealing with human beings, and they have emotions. And what you're saying to him is nothing but negativity.
Well, and also, I would assume that you're kind of turning off whatever the interaction of muscle memory and reflexes and everything. You're trying to defeat a whole system that a player has been learning in many cases since he was maybe 5 or 6 years old.
No question about it. I used to get on Weaver, too, on Baylor. Baylor was a definite streak hitter. He'd go into what I call a favorable chance deviation, and he could hit anybody. It didn't matter who was out there. But Earl still went back with these stats. You know, I remember one day in Milwaukee, he went 3-for-4, he hit a triple and a home run. Next day, he wasn't in the lineup. And I came in to Earl and said, are you crazy? This guy's a straight hitter. He said, no, he doesn't hit this guy. I said, no. He's in a favorable chance deviation, Earl. Figure it out. Of course, he chased me out then, too.
You know, Bauer had a similar story about Stengel, that he went, and as Bauer told the story over the years, the number of hits and extra base hits increased, but he had a 4-for-4 or a 3-for-3. It changed, but it was a double and two home runs, and he got pinch hit for in his last at bat, and he asked Stengel why, and Stengel said, I felt you had reached your quota.
That's funny. You know, that stuff is going around even today. You know, it's funny.
So I want to ask you a question, and I was fortunate enough to ask Paul Blair, your late teammate, this many years ago, and he had, I don't know if you call it the fortune or misfortune, he played his entire career or just about his whole career for Earl Weaver and then Billy Martin, and I was very curious how it was that he didn't shake himself to death some days with the stress of being around such high-pressure guys. And he just shook his head and laughed, and he said, you know, you could never tell what the Weaver was going to do, and you had to be alert. But I wondered, when Weaver, and in the book you portray yourself as not being fazed by too much, and I note, by the way, that in managerial ejections all time, you trail Earl by like 95 to 37, so you were comparatively low-key. But as a player, when the manager is going to go out and have those kinds of theatrics as often as he did and be so dramatic, is that a distraction to you? Does it help you? Did it make you feel more tense? What was the overall effect of his behaving that way?
Well, I think what he was trying to do is take the heat off the players, you know, and put it on the umpire. And he was very good at that. I remember, you know, the first time I went and argued with an umpire, I kicked dirt on home plate like he did all the time, and he threw me out of the game. He said, that Earl Weaver crap isn't going to come over here. You know, but I like playing against guys like Billy Martin. I mean, he was on me all the time, and he would be yelling at me and cussing me, and then I would send him, you know, while I was on first base, I'd send him little hand signals about what I thought of him. And we always had it out, but I loved the competitive nature of another manager like that. And to me, it was great. It stimulated players, not only your team, but also opposing players.
You know, along the lines of Earl and Billy and even yourself, I kept as I was reading the book, the front cover is a picture of you in your Mets uniform in the 80s, and the back cover is you now. And obviously, 30 years have gone by. But you look a lot more relaxed now than you did then. And I was thinking back to Billy, and obviously he had other stuff going on. But whenever Steinbrenner would have a press conference where he called Billy back from whatever exile he was in, Billy would look tanned and rested and, for Billy, healthy. And then not too long into the season, he looked like he was about to die. And, you know, I used to watch you on the Mets game, and I don't mean to make this overly personal, but I could see your eyes were tired, that you were fidgeting in the dugout. The tension was palpable. And looking at you now, again, you look a lot more relaxed. So, I mean, do we not appreciate just how much stress major league managers are under?
Well, you know, I never really felt like it was much stress. It was, you get totally involved in the game, totally immersed in every situation. And you're actually thinking not only this at bat, but, you know, a couple innings ahead. And you get so involved in your thought process that it probably causes you to look like you're having stress, but you're not. You're just figuring things out, how you want it to play out and how you anticipate things to play out. The biggest stress in the big leagues wasn't dealing with the writers or the players. To me, was the constant travel and living in another hotel room away from home. And that was the most difficult part. And once you don't have to do that, I mean, I've loved being home. You know, I mean, for 51 years, I was never home. You know, and I have a nice house, and I've always had a nice house on the water, and I always had a nice dog. But as a manager, you don't get to experience that. And so now that I'm getting to experience it, my wife is giving me a hard time. She wants me to go take her to New Zealand to go fishing, to Bora Bora, to Tahiti, to Alaska, you name it. She still likes to travel, but not this cracker boy.
You did all the traveling, albeit, you know, you were going to Cleveland four times a year or something. It's maybe not quite the same as New Zealand.
No, but I enjoyed it, and I took my wife with me on most trips, and because I felt like that was the easier way to keep your marriage together, by being together all the time. And she's a tough lady. She's got this big charity now that, of course, SOS, Sport Art Scholars, all these underage girls. She's giving them mentors and providing financial assistance through college. And that's why I did this book, Steve. And she and her son wanted me to do it. And I said, okay, it's a good idea. You know, I guess you can use the money for your scholarships for your girls. So here we are.
And she had been involved in this kind of thing for a long time. And you talk about, and this is some of the heavier material in the book, that you suffered a couple of losses in your case, your daughter, and in her case, really both of you, because he became a big part of your life too, her son. And before her son passed, he had been a rubella measles baby, excuse me, and had been born severely handicapped, and she had set up organizations to help care for people like that.
Yeah, she had to raise $1 million a year. She wanted to give these kids an education, teach them about the calendar and how to sign, and she was great about that. You know, another thing she did that she doesn't ever get any credit for, she organized the wives on every team and then took it nationally, organized all the major league wives to do good works in their communities. And you know, it's still going today. The wives of major league players are doing great, great charity work.
I guess this is the place to mention, and this always stuns me, that when you were manager of the Cincinnati Reds, Marge Schott, who on one hand is saying Nazi Germany wasn't so bad, is on the other hand saying to you, you have to make an honest woman of that girlfriend of yours or you can't manage this team.
Well, that's true. And, you know, I love her for that. You know, I was going to get married. You know, first, you know, she stayed with me all 1 year and traveled with me and whatever, and because I wanted to see if she could deal with that, you know, having kids and that kind of life. And Marge said, if you don't marry her, make an honest woman out of her, you can't manage this ball club. And so I said, well, fine, I was going to do it anyway. And then instead of getting married in Cincinnati, where Marge might have attended, I got married in the Keys. But it didn't last very long. She fired me for Ray Knight, you know. So that was another part of the story.
Well, she was erratic in a lot of of different ways. And I was relieved reading the book that you had one advantage over Lou Piniella in that you only had to have the dog hair in your pocket. Lou Piniella actually had to take his shirt off and have the dog hair rubbed on his chest.
I know. It was weird. I mean, I enjoyed it there because my wife is from Cincinnati. And so her whole family used to come to ball games, and it was a great time.
Lou did win a World Series, so you know maybe there was something to it.
Maybe it helped. Maybe I messed up. I might have made a big mistake.
So let me ask you, just more broadly speaking, I think the one way that your voice in the book comes through really, really clearly, and I alluded to this before, is you just express this relentless self-confidence and. The phrase, okay, it was another challenge. I was looking for another challenge. I was ready to move on to the next thing. It comes up again and again. And I'll tell you, Davey, you don't know me, but sort of insecurity is a big part of my brand here. That doesn't seem to be part of your makeup. And I wonder if that's something that you always had or it was something that you learned over the course of your life.
Well, I always felt if you did the right thing and for all the right reasons and everywhere I went as a manager, I wanted to make sure that the ball players lived up to their potential. And if you did all the things that would increase the asset value of the players in the organization and you didn't hinder their development, I think that you could always be thankful for that. It's very difficult, the relationship between a general manager and the manager. And then there's another relationship between the ownership and the general manager. And a lot of their decisions will go against what the field manager knows best for the organization. But he can't control that. But I never felt bad because whatever they wanted to do, I would try to support, even though I was against it. And then when they took it out on me and fired me, I would have loved to have been just stayed in one place my whole life. And I thought it was going to be in New York. But that didn't work out, and so I kept getting more challenges. Boom, boom, boom.
And there was never a moment at any time of I mean, you do. I don't want to make it sound like you don't ever express any regrets in the book, because you do. But there was never a moment where you fell down about these things or I mean, frustrated, sure, but you didn't feel defeated at any point by some of this opposition that you went through?
No, I never really did. I mean, I have... You know, I think, number one, I don't have a big ego, number one, so I don't need everybody telling me how great I am or something. Because I think if you do, and you feel in your own mind that you've done the best you possibly could do in every situation, what's to look back on it for? I mean, it doesn't make any sense. I have a lot of confidence in my abilities, not only in baseball, but in the real estate field and in life in general, that... You'll put all the data in the computer or your brain, and you'll come out with the best decision possible.
You mentioned the real estate business, and I wondered if that helped you with that confidence in the sense, and I don't mean to keep going back to Casey Stengel. He's somebody who comes up for me a lot, but he had investments outside of baseball. He got into oil and pharmaceuticals and banks, and so after a certain point, he didn't need the job. He did it for the love of the game and for the challenge of winning World Series, which obviously he did a lot. But he had the ability to walk away from jobs and to turn some down, both of which he did in the majors and minors. And I wondered if you're having the off-field success in real estate and having that kind of a backstop allowed you to be pickier about what you were doing and to not feel as dependent as other managers might who might not have that same financial backing.
Well, even as that's just true, but I think the first thing I ever did when I ever made any money, I always felt like I had to let that money work for me and not make bad decisions on how I invested money. My grandfather, died penniless and left my grandmother nothing. My father was the same way. And I always felt that the responsibility to do the right thing, not when you're making some money, invest it. Invest it in something that's going to grow. And I didn't know anything about the stock market, but I knew something about real estate. And the first three investments I made when I got a bonus to sign with the Orioles were buy a car, a Pontiac convertible, set of golf clubs, Hague Ultras, and boom, a lot from my family's estate for $7,000 on the water. I mean, I wanted to do the right thing, and I'd also do some frivolous things like the car and the golf clubs, but, you know, that's part of it.
You gotta have heart. All you really need is heart. When the odds are saying you'll never win, that's when the grin should start. You've gotta have hope. Mustn't sit around and mope. Nothing's half as bad as it may appear. Just wait till next year and hope.
You're listening to Bing Crosby sing the manager's song, You've Gotta Have Heart, from the 1955 Broadway musical Damn Yankees, music by Richard Adler and Jerry Ross. You know, Casey Stengel hated that show. Someone asked him if he had seen it, and he said, no, I'm not going to see anything where someone made $1 million talking about my team losing. Eddie Fisher had a number 6 hit with this that same year, 1955. We'll take a break for a word from our sponsor, and then we'll be back with more conversation with Davy Johnson.
First, you gotta have heart.
The areas where you had confidence where I felt like you differed from a lot of managers, and this is from opposite ends of your career, really, the beginning with the Mets and the end with the Nationals, in that you brought along teenage players to the major leagues, Dwight Gooden on the one hand and Bryce Harper on the other. And in retrospect, obviously, it's really easy for us to say, oh, these were special, unique talents, and it all worked out in the end. But a lot of managers and organizations are reluctant to do that. And there seems to be the sense that even if this kid has dominated in the minor leagues, if he comes up to the majors somehow and doesn't succeed instantly, he's going to be ruined for all time. But you had the confidence in your judgment to take these really young players up. And I wonder how hard you had to push for that, and how it is that you didn't have that same mindset about their having such fragility.
Well, you know, one thing about it, when, you know, as a baseball player, and, you know, I was a lifer, and you appreciate good talent. You know, I mean, I broke in with the Orioles and my roommate was a guy named Aparicio. I mean, he taught me how to throw. I mean, Brooks Robinson taught me how to feel and how to go about the work ethic. And when you see other players that are at that same level and their work ethic and everything, and it's really about makeup. You know, if the makeup is there, I always take a makeup guy over talent. And sure, I'd fight for them because they deserve to be at that level at that time. You know, and I just wanted them to be, you know, not overly whelmed, but successful in the whole thing, in the whole process. And it was fun. It was never any doubt in my mind. Those guys were ready. You know, the bad thing is, along the way, sometimes they may get off track. And that's where I think a manager and his parents all come into play.
I wanted to ask you about that. One thing that always has been a little opaque to me about managers and their role in the clubhouse. And I'll give you an example in that a couple of weeks ago, I had Greg Pryor on here. You might remember Greg played for the Royals quite a bit in the 80s. And we were talking about Dick Houser and Dick Houser's illness. And he said that one of the reasons that he knew that Houser was sick was that Houser was coming into the clubhouse and talking to them, which he didn't normally do, and that even though Houser had a good relationship with the players, that it's not baseball etiquette that you pop into the clubhouse before a game and say, hi, coach, let's have a great game, that kind of thing. You talk to the manager when the manager wants to talk to you, and otherwise there can be a certain amount of distance there. And I feel like even you, to a certain extent, you talk about in the book about delegating with the Mets clubhouse matters to Keith Hernandez and Gary Carter. So does it vary from player to player or from team to team in terms of just how much actual interfacing you do with the players outside of the game?
No, I think the manager, I was never big in big team meetings. I always felt like that they were unnecessary. I think if you set up, you know, I always had owners and general managers say, we got to make the clubhouse smaller because they're too, everybody's apart. Well, and we don't have the chemistry. Well, you have chemistry when everybody knows their role. And the way everybody knows their role is not only do you put them in the right situation and give them an opportunity to improve that situation by their performance, but all the conversations mostly that are the most important are individual conversations. My wife must be having delivered some more books. So I'm going to a book signing today, and my dogs greet everybody that way.
I understand.
But you understand what I'm saying?
I do.
The conversations with your players and your team, if they're on an individual basis, they're more heartfelt because they know that nobody else is listening, and they know exactly what you're saying and what they're saying is being heard.
You know, just to go back to the Orioles for a second, I don't know if this is a correct perception on my part, but I have to imagine that even if one were tempted to dog it on a given day, it must have been scary to look up at Frank Robinson and realize that he was going to get on you after that.
you know, Frank was the greatest. Everybody on the team learned a lot from him, and he was the reason we went to another level because he had great talent, and he played with a chip on his shoulder. And, you know, nobody wanted to cross him, you know. He was the best.
To go back to the Mets for a second, one of the things that has been, I think, tremendously unfair in terms of your legacy there is that for almost 30 years now, you've been made to take a lot of heat for the Lenny Dykstra, Roger McDowell trade that acquired Juan Samuel. And that strikes me, the reason that I characterize it as unfair is that it was a really first guessable move right at the very beginning.
I was against that the whole time. I mean, I love both those guys. And I one of the things I'm sorry, I'm on the phone. Never mind, I can't talk to you. That's what I'm trying to say. My dogs are outside. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. Do you need to...
My life now. This is my life now. You know.
They like me. I think they're swell. Isn't it remarkable how things work out so well? Pleasant day. Pretty sky. Life goes on, here I lie. Not bad, not bad at all. Cozy home, board and bed, sturdy roof beneath my head. Not bad, not bad at all.
So, listen, I know we had a break not that long ago, and normally I like to space them out a bit more. I think it makes for a better experience for you, but it was at this moment that I offered Davey the chance to take a break and go corral his German Shepherd and his Burmese Doodle, who had been let out by a lady who had wandered up to his door, asking if Davey was a doctor. I wish I had been fast enough to say, yes, a team doctor. And so we will reset with Bill Hinnant singing Snoopy from the original 1967 production of You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown, and then we'll be right back.
I feel every now and then that I gotta fight someone. I know every now and then what I wanna be. A fierce jungle animal crouched on the limb of a tree.
So we're talking about the Juan Samuel trade.
It was a terrible trade. I mean, he wasn't a good second baseman, and the whole thing started this way. I told Frank Cashin that, you know, when we traded Mookie, I said, Lenny, the first year I play him every day, he's going to probably hit 220, and but he'll still be on base about, you know, over 300, and... But then he's going to be fine. because I've been platooning him to keep Mookie in the lineup. And so he said, well, we can't take a step back like that. I said, it's the best thing. And then they go ahead and do the trade. And then what was even worse, I said, okay, I'll support it. Then they said that I forced the trade, which was even worse, But that's the way it works,
I guess the story supposedly was, I'm not saying that this was actually your point of view, but what seemed to get out in the papers was that you had found Dykstra uncoachable and too home run obsessed, and you wanted somebody who was more content to be a traditional leadoff hitter.
No, I mean, he was a great leadoff hitter. I mean, I did have to get on him occasionally because he wanted to gain more weight, he wanted to get bigger, he did want to hit home runs, and I would, but that's just part of, explaining to a player that he doesn't need that, And he came into camp when you're overweight because he'd been trying to bulk up. And I said, your deal is speed and you can hit the ball out of the ballpark, but you're tough to, pitch to because you are a threat. I mean, he'd take pitches all the time and set them up and then they'd throw one right down the middle and he'd be swinging. But he just was I used to play golf with him too, and I could beat him. I could give him 8 shots and beat him. And he decides he wants to play me even. So no, I'll play you $50 a hole even. I said okay, and he'd be down about $400 or $500. He said okay, I'm not going to play you this next hole. I said okay, and then he'd say, on this hole I'm going to play you for $100. He was just a bad. He had a lot of confidence, which I loved, but. He made some bad decisions, and when he was making all that money and told me he sold his car washes for $55 million, I said, great for you. I said, you should have just kept them because you were spending all the money he was making.
Right.
And then he was making money in the stock market, and guys would call me and said, you want to invest with what he's doing? I said, no possible way. No possible way, because I know he's going to try to make it into $1 billion, and he's going to lose it. And that's what he did.
And in the meantime, you were stuck with a center fielder who wasn't really a center fielder, and that seems like kind of a problem.
Yeah, that was a problem. But you had to try to make it work, and it was difficult.
One of the takeaways that I had from that and from some of the other situations that you were in, the Mets front office was supposed to be so smart as they built up that team. And I don't think that Frank Cashin and everybody got dumb necessarily, but it seems like everybody, every team, this extends throughout baseball history, I think, in that everybody knows how to build up. And, you lose, especially in the draft era, you get some high draft picks, so you come up with a Gooden and a Strawberry, you make some smart additions of veterans. I don't have to tell you who you guys added. And then what nobody really knows is how you maintain it. And that's where the Mets struggled.
Yeah, one of the toughest things is, from a field point of view, is you don't know what the constraints are on ownership and say, well, we can't afford to pay this guy, keep paying this guy, so we got to get rid of him, But I think growing up in the Oriole organization and also when I first got to the Met organization and I'm starting the minor leagues, the minor league talent is the most important. Develop the talent. And the guys that managed them in those minor league cities and towns, they were the most important people, as far as I was concerned, in the whole organization, because they were going to develop talent to feed the big league club. And the clubs, if you look today, they've gone back. The clubs that are really being successful have developed a really good minor league system, Yankees, Braves, and I think it's great.
One other thing that came up in the book that I really want to ask you about, because I don't know if this will surprise you or not, but for a person who has expressed as much confidence in his judgments as you did, I thought you were actually unfair to yourself in this one regard. And it's that you said that one of the big regrets of your managerial career was that you were not able to do more to deflect Dwight Gooden and Daryl Strawberry from whatever off-the-field problems they were having. And the question that I asked myself at that point was, how? Because, you weren't John McGraw with private detectives trailing the players after hours. And in fact, you made a point of saying that if the players come to the ballpark prepared, you didn't necessarily care what they were doing in terms of after hours and setting curfews and all of that old-fashioned stuff. But I don't think, maybe this is less a question than my trying to say that it's a noble dream, maybe a great dream. I don't think that any manager in baseball history, and whether it's Casey and Mickey or Joe McCarthy and Hack Wilson, that if a player was going to do something self-destructive, I don't think that any manager, however well-meaning, ever saved that person.
Yeah, well, you know, I always, you know, Dwight Gooden was such a great young man. I mean, first one in the ballpark, he was a switcher, all these good things. I mean, he loved the game. He was always cheerful and whatever. But, you know, if I'd have known that he just didn't know how to say no to his homies, if I'd have known that he meant no, but he didn't know how to follow it up, I could maybe have helped him say no. And I thought Kevin Mitchell would have been a good guy to help him say no, but they felt like he was going to be a bad influence, but that was not the case. He was going to be a good influence. And the same way with Strawberry. You know, but now Strawberry's on the right path, and I'm still worried about Doc. You know, that's the big move.
That's one of the great ironies. Kevin Mitchell never got in trouble that way.
No, I mean, he came from the toughest area in San Diego, and I knew it. I knew, and he was the best-looking young right-hand hitter I've ever seen. And I got him 350 bats the year before they traded him, and I was going to play him every day the next year. And, you know, they just wanted to trade him because they felt like he was going to be a bad influence on Doc and Straw. And I said, he's the best. But they didn't believe it, you know. So that was one of my regrets.
And you were using him like Ben Zobrist. You were using him everywhere, and he didn't look like a shortstop, but as we talked about earlier, it didn't matter sometimes.
Didn't matter. I mean, if he didn't play shortstop against the Cardinals when Tudor pitched, we'd never won. he was the only guy I had in the lineup could even hit Tudor, and he'd kill him. But I loved the guy. I mean, I knew he was tough, and I mean, he and I even ran into each other later on, and but I still respected that in him. He fought for what he believed in, and he was good.
It struck me that you never would have handled Darryl the way that Tommy Lasorda later did, in that when Darryl's problems finally came out, Tommy really jumped on him in the press and just slaughtered him. And you know, somebody asked him, does Strawberry dog it? And Lasorda said, he's not a dog. Dogs are loyal and chase after balls, which is a funny line, but not something you should say about one of your players.
No, I mean, I love Darryl. And he, I felt like, you know, he didn't have much father growing up, and I felt like, you know, I needed to be his father image, and, you know, I would fight him, and I would be tough on him, and he would donate the money to the orphanage there in Queens. He was, you know, he was a good guy at heart, you know, just got off on the wrong track with the same thing with some homies.
Davey, before we go, is there a way that anyone who wants to help your wife and her support our scholars can contribute, or is buying the book just the best way to do it?
Probably buying the book, because she's getting all the money that comes my way. You know, she's got me doing a book show tonight and one tomorrow here in Orlando, and I think Triumph Books has got me doing some stuff up in New York and Washington and whatever. But it's a great, you know, you can check it out along SOS. Support our scholars, and there's a lot of great young underprivileged girls that have really made successes in their life because of my wife.
I really appreciate the fact that you did do the book for a good cause and for taking the time with me. It's really great to read about your life story, and you don't pull any punches. I just want to say that 96 men have managed in the majors for 10 years or more, going back to 1900. Your career winning percentage is 562, is in the top 10, and it's higher than Bobby Cox and Joe Torre and Tony La Russa. Anybody that we could name, basically, outside of a handful of guys, you should be in the Hall of Fame, in my opinion, and it's really an honor and a pleasure for me to have the time with you today.
Well, Stephen, thank you for all those nice words, but I'm very happy in my little old house with my two little dogs. They staying close to me because I got to take them to the doggy park. That's my job in the day, and that's the only thing in my box that I have to do today, other than another radio show and sign a bunch of books.
It's nice work if you can get it. Davey, have a great day.
It is. Same to you, Stephen. You take care.
By Earl Weaver's last lucky strike, we have reached the end of another show. You can follow Davey Johnson on Twitter, believe it or not, at the Davey Johnson. As for me, you can follow me at Go Stephen Goldman. Why Go Stephen Goldman? Because I tried the Stephen Goldman, and then I thought, well, wait, what if I'm not him? There are a lot of Stephen Goldmans out there. It'd be really unfair to them, and I'm not that definitive. And just then, someone walked up and said, whosoever shall pulleth this sword from this stone shall be king of all England. And he did it. So go Stephen Goldman. You can also write us, by which I mean me, at infiniteinning@gmail.com. And feel free to join the Infinite Inning discussion group at Facebook. And please, rate us at the podcatcher of your choice, Apple, iTunes, what have you, if it allows that kind of thing. It is greatly appreciated. We have a sponsor now, but nevertheless, this episode is brought to you by the number 5. Our producer is Juan Samuel Davis Jr. Our theme song, which you have been hearing throughout the episode, and in fact are listening to right now, was a co-composition of myself and Dr. Rick Mooring. Back in elementary school, Rick used to pal around with this kid who used to take his cafeteria-issued baked beans, put them on a plastic spoon, and fling them to the ceiling where they would just stick. I was back recently and they're still there. That was 1979 or so. Well, if Frank Cashin doesn't package me with Sean Abner, Stan Jefferson, Kevin Mitchell, Kevin Brown, and Kevin Armstrong for Kevin McReynolds, I'll be back next week with more tales and discussion from inside the Infinite Inning.